think there's an aspect of this that's important. I think it is the lesson that most changes that are occurring in brains, when brains are losing functionality, are reversible. Or from a child perspective, most of the limitations that are recorded in the brain of a child, in fact, are improvable. Whatever you struggle with, in a sense, as it stems from your neurology, the inherent plasticity of brain gives you a basis for improvement. This is a way underutilized and underappreciated resource that we all have.
Welcome to Year 3 of the Brain Science Podcast, the show for everyone who has a brain. I'm your host, Dr. Ginger Campbell. On the Brain Science Podcast, we discuss some of the latest books in neuroscience, and I interview scientists, philosophers, and other leading thinkers. Our goal is to explore how neuroscience is unraveling the mystery of how our brains make us who we are. Please visit our website at brainsciencepodcast.com or send me email at docartemus@gmail.com. This is episode 54 of the Brain Science Podcast. Today, I am talking with Dr. Michael Merzenich, who was one of the pioneers in the field of neuroplasticity. He will share some of the highlights of his long career with us and give us some practical advice about how we can continue to tap our brain's plasticity, whatever our age. Before I get into the interview, I want to thank those of you who are supporting the Brain Science Podcast with your donations. And I also want to apologize to those of you whose emails I have not yet answered. I still haven't gotten caught up, but rest assured, I read all of your emails. Now let's get on into the interview. I want to welcome my guest today to the Brain Science Podcast. It's Dr. Michael Merzenich. Well, I've talked about your work a lot on my podcast, so it's a great privilege to have you on the show today.
Well, it's nice to talk to you, Ginger.
The discovery of neuroplasticity is one of the most exciting recent developments in neuroscience. And since you are one of the pioneers in this area, I was hoping that maybe we could start by looking back at the early part of your career and working our way forward.
Sure.
How did you first get interested in neuroscience?
Well, it really came from an interest as a young student in issues of philosophy and psychology. Originally, I became interested in studying, you could say, the great issues of philosophy in the brain. As a sort of joke, I called myself an applied philosopher when I was young. But really what I meant was that as a neuroscientist, my interest was in these more complex issues of the origin of the abilities as they're explained by the brain and, you know, how we can explain ourselves in a sense on the basis of our neurology.
That's interesting. That's kind of how I got into this podcast.
Yeah, well, these are the greatest among the greatest of human questions, of course. It's what we're all about and how that's explained or not explained by what we understand about our brains.
I know that you did your PhD work under Vernon Mountcastle, and I was wondering if you could explain to my listeners why Dr. Mountcastle's work is so important.
Well, he was a great lion of neuroscience. He actually discovered basic features of the organization of the cerebral cortex. He was one of the first persons to really define what's called the cortical column, which is the basic processing unit of the cerebral cortex. This is very elementary to our science. A lot of our science has been based upon these early discoveries of his, but he was also one of the first neuroscientists that attempted to explain aspects of perception, of feeling, in neurological terms. And that's specifically why I decided as a young scientist to go work with him. So he was trying to explain the very elemental basis of, you could say, a perceptual moment, what constituted the basis of awareness, or what really accounted for your ability to distinguish one thing that you felt or that you saw from another. These very elemental aspects of perception he was trying to explain in neurological terms. And this was my meat. This is the kind of thing I was interested in as a young scientist. And he was a wonderful, wonderful mentor. And in fact, he is to this day a wonderful source of wisdom for me.
And what did you study for your PhD thesis?
Well, I actually studied aspects of sensation that come from the skin. And I did a combination of experiments in psychology and behavioral measurement and physiological measurement in the brain. And this is exactly what I was interested in a sense, was try to account for dimensions of behavior by dimensions of response that I could record in the brains, in this case, of animals.
When did you get interested in neuroplasticity? I know it wasn't called that back then, but...
Well, actually, when I was a young scientist, most people viewed the brain as being rigid in its organization and not plastic beyond an early period in early development and childhood. But there was a background interest and background current of experiment and thought that was being pursued in that period by people from the physiological side of neuroscience, who called themselves physiological psychologists. They were doing relatively convincing experiments across the epoch at the time that I was being trained, documenting aspects of plasticity primarily in the hearing cortex and in the motor cortex. And to make a long story short, I pursued those interests primarily in reading, didn't do too many experiments that related to them in my young career. But then I became interested in the cochlear implant. And the cochlear implant is a hearing substitution device. The cochlear implant provides very compelling evidence of the power of plasticity in the older or adult brain. And that certainly re-stimulated my interest in plasticity in general. And then I began to do experiments in animals in the 1970s, which demonstrated the power of plasticity in the adult brain. Basically, I began to see the possibilities, the explanatory possibilities that this provided for us, and began to see how this must be in play, powerfully in play, in the development of our human abilities, and that it was in play throughout life.
Let's back up to the cochlear implant for a few minutes.
Sure.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that work? And I'm particularly interested in why scientists at that time were convinced that a cochlear implant couldn't work.
Well, I had a lot of reasons, but one reason was that they believed that the inner ear was so fragile that surgery on it was just an impossibility, that any attempt to introduce a mechanical device into the inner ear would result in its utter destruction. Cochlear implant is an electrical stimulation device which is designed to excite or shock the auditory nerve, the hearing nerve, in a person that basically has lost hearing because the sensory organ itself has been damaged or lost through pathology or through injury or whatever. They're deaf because the hearing organ is severely damaged or degenerated. And yet we know that in most of those individuals, the hearing nerve is intact. Well, there was a religious belief on one side of the clinical hearing community and the research community that if you introduced any instrument into the inner ear, it would result in ultimate final loss of that surviving nerve. And we quickly demonstrated in the early 1970s that that just wasn't true, that we could introduce practical devices into the inner ear, and it had no very significant impact on the survival of the nerve itself, so we could shock it. And in fact, it could put up with that and tolerate that. So that was one reason people didn't believe it. The second reason was that people did not believe that you could provide adequate control of stimulation in the inner ear, control on a level that would really provide a basis of simulating that incredibly complicated normal input that represents complex signal like oral speech. So they were very skeptical about generating a faithful enough representation in simulation of that complexly coded information that the normal inner ear delivers to the brain. For them to be effective, that simulation had to be acceptably sophisticated. Now, on the other hand, we were optimistic because we knew that in communication science, people had demonstrated that you could reduce the information in speech very substantially. And the speech might not sound perfectly normal, but it was still understandable, still intelligible. Interestingly, at that time, Ginger, we weren't really counting on brain plasticity to contribute to the improvement of what a person heard. It turns out that the brain makes really amazing adjustments to the cochlear implant once it's in place. And even though you don't initially understand what you're hearing, not so long after, most people understand everything. And the reason they do is because of the remarkable plasticity of the brain. That is to say, the way we represent information to the brain is, in fact, not very good. We are quite limited in relation to that real sophisticated information that the normal ear delivers to the brain, but the brain doesn't care. It makes beautiful plastic adjustments, and it gets the most out of that information. And as a consequence, the speech for most cochlear implant users is completely intelligible. They understand pretty much everything that people say to them and have high normal uses of it.
So you think that in retrospect, the plasticity is a very important component of why it works?
Absolutely. The engineers that work on this device have mostly credited themselves with the miracle, but actually it's God or Mother Nature, whoever invented cortical plasticity.
So in a person that's got a cochlear implant, that's put in the inner ear?
Right.
Are the bones of the middle ear still intact in a person who's using a cochlear implant?
No, and they don't matter because basically you're bypassing all of that normal sound transmission system. And you're receiving the sound and you're encoding it as a pattern of electrical stimulation. And you're shocking the nerve to generate a pattern input to the brain that's a simulation of the normal pattern that would be represented if all of that transmission machinery was in place. So basically, you're providing an artificial way to provide coded information to the brain about the complex sounds of speech. You can only do that crudely. In the intact ear, there are more than 30,000 nerve fibers that are providing information about sounds from the ear to the brain. And, you know, you can stimulate 10 or 15 or 20 channels of information with an electrical device. Those are practical limits. That's a little bit like playing Chopin with your forearms. You know, it's crude. And, of course, the brain initially struggles to interpret it with any significant accuracy. And most people initially don't understand what they're hearing very well. They describe this speech as robotic or as very noisy or very difficult to interpret. And 3 or 4 or 5 months later, the majority of people have acquired relatively high levels of speech understanding. They understand pretty much everything that's said to them. They understand what they hear over the telephone or when their back is turned to somebody. And they describe what they hear as being pretty normal. Sounds like it sounded like when my hearing was intact many years ago. And we know that they're doing this with very different, very much altered patterns of activation of the nerve and activation in the brain. And what makes all that possible is the plasticity of their brain. Their brain basically is reinterpreting the speech, is processing in ways that provide them with a new basis for interpreting and understanding it. So they're powerful resources that they had all along, you could say, that substantially account for the miracle of understanding.
Could you use a cochlear implant in somebody who was congenitally deaf?
Yes, and there the problems are a little bit more complicated. The biggest benefits come when the child is very young. And in fact, the greatest success comes with implantation of children of a relatively young age. And the reason for that is because the auditory cortex doesn't just sit there without uses in a person that's born deaf. Basically, it's subsumed by inputs that come primarily from vision. And in fact, if a person learns American Sign Language, which most deaf individuals do in American culture or the equivalent sign languages in another culture, it's actually very heavily engaged in representing that language in the brain. As if you're hearing, instead of hearing, that same cortex is used very beautifully to represent hearing by vision. For those reasons, for complicated reasons in older and older ages, it's more and more difficult to, you could say, reestablish this cortex as hearing cortex. So ultimately, it's more and more complicated and more difficult to make this complete translation conversion of the functional uses of these broad reaches of cortex for the second purpose, a hearing purpose. But those effects are very strong in young brains.
And that's consistent with what we now know about the competitive nature of neuroplasticity.
Exactly. Exactly right.
Would you like to talk a little bit about your work with animals? Did you work mainly with monkeys?
Well, initially we did many experiments in monkeys, and then gradually we made a transition more and more to studies in rats. Because we discovered that we could answer most of the questions that we're interested in rats. And because the human methods themselves became more and more effective, instead of doing those second-order experiments in monkeys, which is always difficult to do, we do now most of our second-order experiments directly in humans. We can leap across, you could say, from rats to humans. So our current strategy, and the strategy for a number of years now, has been predominantly using the rat model. And on the basis of things we can only learn in a real brain, we can't learn it directly from the brain of a human, then we can do these basic things and then extend them to studies in humans.
Would you explain what you mean by second-order studies?
Well, I mean, commonly, issues that relate to fundamental process or mechanism can only be conducted using at least moderately invasive procedures where we actually record from the brain. And then we document aspects of the consequences of what we're doing physically, anatomically, chemically in the brain. And to be precise enough to really interpret what's happening in the brain as you learn, a common model is that we study the consequences of a particular environmental or genetic history in the brain, and we see that the brain is degraded in its operations. And then we're trying to define how we can, in that brain, in that animal, in that individual, drive improvements in its operations. We need to get to the details, and we can't get to the details in the same way in a human experiment as we can in an animal experiment. But once we know the lay of the land, we can use the human experiment in a confirmatory way, and we commonly do that. So, for example, we might actually see the processes or mechanisms that tell us how to improve some physical or chemical aspect of the operation of a brain, and then carry that to a human experiment with a secondary measure that tells us that the same thing is likely happening in the human brain.
So that's like using an fMRI to determine how the map has changed compared to using actual electrodes in the neurons.
Yeah, an example of this, Ginger, is that currently we do experiments in which we've demonstrated that most of the things that occur in an aging brain, most of the changes that occur, many, many changes can be recorded in an old brain in an animal. So we have a list of 25, 30 things that change physically, chemically, functionally in the brain, none of them for the better.
Mm-hmm.
And then we exercise the brain, we train the brain in different ways. And it turns out that virtually every one of these things, every one of these physical, functional, chemical aspects are reversible. In a rat, we can take a rat that's near the end of life, and we can drive it functionally so that it looks like a rat that's a young adult. Commonly, we can drive them back so that they look like they're 3 to 6 months of age when the rat dies at about 3 years of age normally. So we're going to have these really striking reversals in ability. Well, now we can go to a human model, and we can look in an older human at the ability to reverse these dimensions of function. Now, we can't measure all of these things directly, but we can assay them in various ways indirectly. An example would be that if we improve in the rat the conduction speeds in pathways in the brain, well, we can set up a specific experiment on an appropriate pathway in a human brain, and we can actually determine whether or not we perturb its speed when we do the thing that was effective in working in a rat. But we do many experiments of this class in which we're trying to confirm in humans that we're driving the changes in humans that we can drive in the brain of an animal. Always the measurement in humans is less direct.
Right.
We can never be as specific or direct or as close to the real mechanism or process as we are in the animal. So our real deep knowledge of this has come critically out of these animal experiments, increasingly out of experiments in rodents. And that's where most of the insights we have that have led us to improving human performance have come from.
What do you think the most important discoveries of your work with animals have been?
If there's an aspect of this that's important, I think it is the lesson that most changes that are occurring in brains, when brains are losing functionality, are reversible. Or from a child perspective, most of the limitations that are recorded in the brain of a child, in fact, are improvable. We tend to think of the losses that occur, for example, in aging, as reflecting inexorable changes that are occurring in a worn-out machine. And in fact, that's just not the case. Almost every dimension of the way things are changing negatively as you get older are in fact reflecting processes that are fundamentally two-way processes. They can be better or stronger, they can be faster, or they can slow down and weaken. They're reversible processes. Or when we look at, we set up a model of a pathology in which we're going to have progressive loss. So we might have a model of something like, let's say, Parkinson's disease. We're going to have progressive loss across time in all kinds of complicated ways. And we try to track all of those changes and say, oh, we're losing this ability to control our movement cognitively or mentally or to remember or whatever. Most of what's being reflected as loss is reflecting aspects of loss that are reversible. Not everything. There's real pathology. There are real changes that occur that are resistant. But most of the aspects of loss, in fact, are reflecting processes that are adjusting to the pathology and are reversible to a substantial extent. So it provides new insight into how to attack the loss of function or limitations of function in child and adult populations. And it's medicine, Ginger. It's not just loosey-goosey, soft science, let's train and get better kind of stuff. The more we understand it, the more we understand how to control plasticity to drive targeted changes that drive specific benefits on a more sophisticated and complete level than is generally achieved with drugs. It's medicine.
The Brain Science Podcast is part of the new ProMed Network, founded by Jamie Davis of MedicCast and The Nursing Show. If you are looking for a medically oriented podcast, be sure to check out ProMed Network at promednetwork.com. Jamie's site complements the site I started at sciencepodcasters.org, SciencePodcasters.org is the place to go to find science podcasts from a wide variety of fields. I just want to go back to some of the historical stuff for just a minute.
Sure.
And then we'll come back up to the present, because it sounds like you got a lot of exciting stuff going on. When you were working early on, when the idea of plasticity was still not widely accepted,
right?
What was your experience with your colleagues like?
Well, initially, it was really interesting because it was so contrary to the dominant view that the introduction of it, from our perspective, was the response was almost hostile. People were very disbelieving, you could say, and it commonly resulted in almost an insulting response. It illustrates something that happens in science that happens in life in general, and that people develop almost religious perspectives about what they're supposed to believe about even silly things like the brain. There was a dogmatic belief that the brain beyond early life, that the fundamental connections in the brain were established in early life and every neuron knew what to do at a relatively young age, and that beyond that point, it simply wasn't physically or chemically changing in this kind of way. And the demonstration that it was changing, in fact, on a large scale, and that that change occurred across life, basically to the end of life, was not very palatable to the mainstream of science. I might say across this period, there were always a group of scientists coming from the subdiscipline of psychology, from physiological psychology, that had also argued that the brain was plastic. Those were partners in crime, you could say, and were held in equal disrepute by the mainstream of neuroscience and medicine. But it's really interesting that now, you know, you could say everyone believes in plasticity, and now there are 10,000 discoverers of it. But in historic period, I would talk about these experiments that demonstrated the fact of plasticity on a large scale in brains, and people would be insulting about it. Or I'd receive back reviews from papers in the early period that were very insulting, as if I was inventing it, inventing results, or distorting them in some way. You know, the ups and downs of religious scientific belief can be astounding, just as they are in society.
Yeah, a little bit over a year ago, I interviewed Dr. Edward Taub. He happens to have been at the medical school I went to for, I guess, over 20 years, although I didn't realize he was there until I read about it in a book. But he expressed the same kind of frustration. In fact, he said he was very frustrated because he did clinical experiments that he thought were very rigorous and met all the requirements for good clinical research that were essentially ignored.
Right.
Until there was things like fMRI data to support it. I think he also mentioned that some of the work you did, he felt confirmed what he was seeing.
Right. And still, you know, when we begin to appreciate the clinical extensions of this science, which we begin to see rich, you know, in a rich way in the 1980s, I thought, well, this will roll into neurology and psychiatry. And I actually went out of my way to give several talks to neurological societies and psychiatric societies in that period and say, look, this is going to open things up for you. There are possibilities of treatment here that should be on your front burner, that you should be pursuing aggressively. There are non-pharmacological strategies to help people on a wide scale by employing brain plasticity to drive brains in positive and improving directions. And you should be studying this. And those talks were a great hit. You know, they were always, in a sense, found to be provocative and enjoyable, and many people afterward told me how much they liked it, but nobody did anything. Or you could say very few scientists did very much to pursue those possibilities. And the actual translation of this into forms of treatment or therapy that could actually help people has been incredibly slow. Now there's a groundswell.
Yeah.
And now we're seeing intense research across the world in hundreds of places, in which people are attempting to drive this into the world for the benefit of human populations, but it's slow to come. And it's very frustrating. And Ed Taub certainly is an individual that struggle to get people to use things that he knows would very greatly benefit very large numbers, millions of individuals in need of help. It's been very frustrating not to be taken more seriously with more intensity.
The reason I bring this up is that I have a lot of listeners. My listeners range across the age span, but I have quite a few students that listen, and I'd like to give them a taste of both the pluses and the minuses of doing research. If they're the next person who comes up with an original idea about how much tenacity is really required.
Yeah, right. Well, I don't want any young person to think that I've ever had anything but fun being a scientist, even when it is discouraging, and sometimes the rate of progress is discouraging. you know, what a wonderful profession it is and what a privilege it is to, in a sense, to be paid by the public to have this great fun that I've enjoyed and to know that it can have a very powerful, positive human impact. That can be something that can be achieved in a research career in science and in medicine. And I strongly encourage young people, but you have to keep your spirits up at times because there can be negative aspects. And it is a little bit of a roller coaster from the point of view of what people do and do not accept in science.
In your career, you've had more opportunities, I guess, than the average to make a big impact on patients' lives. I was thinking in particular also about your work with dyslexia. I guess that came out of your experience with working with hearing to begin with.
It did. And actually, the initial inspiration for that came from studies that were conducted in monkeys. And we were studying aspects of hearing and plasticity in monkeys. And we began to realize that hearing processes in monkeys were highly plastic, and that we could evaluate the performance of a monkey. These are little New World monkeys from South America. And we'd look at the ability of the monkey to make distinctions about complex stimuli, you could say like speech-like stimuli. And the monkey could be very poor at it initially. And we began to realize that we could dramatically improve the monkey's ability to operate as an accurate receiver of sound by training them appropriately and intensely. And we also began to understand that the processes that we were observing were reversible, and we could drive the ability of that monkey basically in a way that degraded its capacities to understand what it was hearing or interpret what it was hearing. In other words, we began to understand that we could probably take you and train you appropriately over a period of a month or two and degrade your ability to understand what I'm saying. Or we could turn around that training and probably substantially refine your ability to interpret with high accuracy, especially under difficult conditions, what it is I'm saying. And understanding that your ability to operate in a domain like language was fundamentally plastic, that it was subject to substantial refinement if you were less than perfect at it, immediately opened up the possibility that we could probably train a child that wasn't very good at it to be better. And we know that a lot of children aren't very good at it, and among those are children, many children that struggle to learn to read.
I remember when I was in medical school, I got taught a very simple idea of what dyslexia was that didn't involve the auditory component at all.
Right.
Is that pretty well accepted now that it's as much about hearing as it is about the visual?
Right. The fundamental problem, if you could say there's a core problem that limits reading performance, and all dyslexics aren't identical, but the most common problem is a problem in phonemic reception accuracy. The phonemes are the sound parts of words that bear meaning in words. And the problem stems from the fact that the brain has not created the normal representation of the sound parts of words. So now we're going to try to make a translation of the sound parts of words in terms of their letter forms. And that only makes sense if the brain has done the sorting in the normal way, which basically allows the child to appropriately assign a letter, which is a form of representation of the sound, to it. In the abnormal form of brain operations that apply to dyslexic, that translation makes no sense. They do not have normal processing of those sound parts of words, and they're not sorted in the same way in the brain. So that translation makes no sense. So it's fraught with error, and the child struggles to make those relationships, to draw those relationships. We also know that these children commonly have a problem in how they process information serially in fast time. That's also is strongly related to their having created this defective representation of sound inputs in their earlier language listening history. So we now know there's a very large body of evidence which demonstrates that in most children, the core problem is a problem that really stems from language listening, which frustrates this assignment of the letter representational forms to sound.
So you have to learn to listen right before you can learn how to read.
It's only when you're sorting information appropriately does this translation of what, I mean, after all, reading is simply based upon the translation of what you hear in a written form. And if what you hear is not represented in the brain in the normal way, it's a very bad representational system. It really doesn't represent what you hear. So unless you correct that, unless you correct the listening, you cannot really generate a facile reader. I mean, you can do it only by using alternative strategies for reading. You can't use a phonological approach to reading. You have to use a whole word or other approach, then you can be successful. But you can't use the classical, efficient approaches to learn to read. So you have to correct the listening to correct the reading.
And that's how fast forward works?
That's exactly what it's designed to do, is to correct the listening.
Do you want to talk about that just briefly?
Well, it focuses on these fundamental core resources, just like we would approach the training of a monkey to improve the facility with which it resolves the details of what it hears in order to make it a more efficient and more accurate processor of complex things arriving in hearing in high speed. So too can we train any child to be better in the accuracy and in the speed at which it receives and interprets information in its brain through listening. You can improve any normal child, but you can also improve children that are substantially impaired in those abilities and drive most of them to a normal performance level without too many hours of intensive exercise. And you can demonstrate that through such progressive training, they can achieve relatively normal or more normal phonological processing that enables reading. So you see big impacts with relatively short amount of time spent in training, both in language accuracy, language reception, and language usage and in reading.
And once the child has reached normal, do they have to keep doing the exercises, or is the effect?
No, there's a very high retention in ability, and it's been measured in several scientific ways. Let me just say that the average gain in language abilities for a child that sits on the left side of the normal distribution below the 50th percentile, the average gain in control studies is about a standard deviation. So that would mean that if the child is at the 16th percentile, let's say, which would mean that they would be on the edge of eligibility for services as a kid that needs special help, special needs kid in most states, that kid on the average is driven to about the normal median.
That's pretty impressive.
And that occurs with about 20 to 25 hours of training.
Over how much time would that usually be done in?
Well, usually it's done 50 minutes a day.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be about 25 to 30 days spent, an hour a day, 50 minutes a day. And then the second thing that's seen is that if the child is behind in reading, the gain that occurs with the single listening program translates to an improvement of reading of about 1.5 to 2 years. In other words, if I train the child and now I make the child as an accurate listener, a more accurate listener, on the average, what you'll see is close to a year's worth of gain in their reading abilities immediately after training. But then if you wait 3 or 4 months in which they're actually reading now with their recovered listening, you see most of a second year gain. So in other words, if a kid is in the fifth grade and they're reading at the level of, let's say, a third grader, most children approach that fifth grade reading level as a consequence of training. They gain those 2 years lost. So these are relatively substantial gains that are seen on the average in these control studies.
Wow. So I've read that fast forward also seems to help children in autism. How does that work?
Well, again, the most common or most consistent deficit that applies on autism, it's one of the DSM-4 criteria for identifying autism, is a language impairment. And in fact, commonly children that have problems that give them the inherited weakness that would result in autism are on a continuum with children that are merely language impaired. In other words, if I have a child that has, let's say, fragile X syndrome because of genetic impairment, and the child is more severe, they might be identified as autistic. They might have an identical twin that's a little less severe, and that twin will be merely language impaired, you could say.
Mm.
So autism is on a continuum with language impairment, and there's lots of studies that show that autism neurologically is related to language impairment. You could say there's something more complicated happens in the brain that results in a whole series of other complex problems for the child that are beyond merely struggling to interpret language.
Mm-hmm.
And the things that come from that. I don't want to dismiss language impairment as being important, but I think you understand what I'm saying. In any event, if the child has a language age of about 4 or greater, the fast forward is demonstrated to be very useful for most children. If the child's language development is more primitive, then it has no measured benefit for language per se.
Mm-hmm.
I did a study in which I just looked longitudinally, historically, when fast forward was first developed, at a series of, I think, 17 autistic children, not completely sure of the number, but it was of that order. About half the children were autistic, about half of them were pervasively developmentally disordered with language impairment, so-called PDD-NOS, not otherwise specified. And to make a long story short, I saw language gains on a language battery that averaged about 1.5 standard deviations. So big effects. But those were selected children that all had some level of language ability when they started.
Mm-hmm.
They were probably also selected by the therapist that trained them as being likely to benefit. But I would say probably about 25 or 30, maybe 35,000 children have been trained who are autistic with a fast forward now. I have people come up to me all the time and tell me that it saved their autistic child's bacon. And whenever it's been looked at all, in a controlled way or in these longitudinal studies, it's been demonstrated to be beneficial in most children, not all, but in most children, but most beneficial in children that are above a certain language age.
Did you redesign Fast Forward to be more helpful to autistic children, or do they still do the original version?
Well, the original version has gone through a series of iterations, so it's better and better and better and easier to get started. And also scientific learning created programs that were designed to help the children to some extent before they initiated Fast Forward. But it hasn't been redesigned as much as it should be. And actually, it's on my agenda as something that we have to do in the very near future. I've just been working on an agreement with Scientific Learning to get permission from them to allow me to do that.
Right, because you're not directly part of that company.
Well, I'm an advisor to them on their research programs, and I communicate with them regularly and try to help them regularly.
But it's a little bit different from your relationship with Posit Science.
It is.
So is there anything else you'd like to talk about before we talk about Posit Science and what you're doing there?
Well, I guess we can talk about Posit Science and talk about what it means for your brain to be plastic in a general sense. You know, I mean, this is a pretty wonderful asset because it means that whatever you struggle with, in a sense, as it stems from your neurology, the inherent plasticity of brain gives you a basis for improvement. One of the things that we're really struck by in all of our animal experiments is, first of all, the dimensions of plasticity in brains of any age. We've been studying plasticity in animals near the end of life for a while now, for example. And once the animal's learning machinery is reinvigorated appropriately, we can generate large-scale changes in these old brains. We can do it in all kinds of specifically targeted ways to improve this ability or this function or that function. This is a way underutilized and underappreciated resource that we all have. I think most of us feel as we're progressing in a neurological condition that we're progressing in life and we're losing functionality, most of us think that we're in a downhill, more or less hopeless and unavoidable slide, and that is just not true. A hell of a lot can be done to reverse or slow down that slide. And one of the challenges in all of this for us, and this is certainly a challenge in Posit Science, is to help people with more tools to help them do that. But also, one of my challenges is to help educate people about how to do that and how to approach that. The brain plasticity science provides a basis of good advice to almost anybody in this situation. And so, you know, there's a whole educational process that has to occur to help people understand it. And I really appreciate what you've been trying to do to achieve that, Ginger.
Thank you. So are there some basic principles that a person who wants to tap their plasticity needs to know?
Well, there are, of course, but it's a little complicated. One thing I can tell you is that commonly people that are struggling basically have withdrawn from life and engagement in serious learning or serious brain change, and they have to reinvigorate their mechanisms, the processes that control learning. You have to find things that you can work on and improve at that are rewarding to you. You have to look at a life of continuous new learning. I don't mean just reading and watching interesting new TV programs. I mean new learning. I mean really engage your brain to acquire new ability. And what you learn has to be serious. You get almost nothing out of exercise or activities in which you're not really focused or engaged, that don't really matter to you. If they don't matter to you, they don't matter to your brain, and nothing will change as a consequence of your activities and so forth. And then your physical status, your physical well-being, physical activity counts for a lot also from the point of view of your brain health. You have to keep that up. So there are principles. It's hard to summarize them in simple ways, but I say a life of continuous learning that's important for you and your brain are really important sides of it.
Being engaged in the world around you in as many ways as possible.
Wake up and smell the roses and start acting on it. You know, pick a few and try to figure out how they work.
When I interviewed Dr. Elkin on Goldberg, he told me that one of the things he does is he makes it a point of doing things, in particular, he mentioned computer things that are somewhat difficult that he could get his graduate students or whatever to do for him,
right,
that he makes the point of doing at least some of those himself for that very reason.
Right. Well, one of the things we do is we disengage and we seek a life of ease and we seek a life that's not challenging, that never really demands anything of us or very little of us. We think that's the happy elder life. And that's a big mistake. Rather than trying to struggle with continuing to figure out how to get across town, we buy the device that tells us where we're at every second so we can do it in a brainless way.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than go out and do something actively, we try to figure out how to bring it in front of us in some way so that we don't have to move off of our butt. And then all of the interactions that would come from actually being there and seeing it and witnessing it or being a part of it are lost. In all kinds of ways, we do things that are designed to destimulate and to reduce our capacity to operate in the world and certainly reduce the way in which we're growing in the world, and that disengage our brains. And that's a mistake. We should be trying to increase and reinvigorate our brains, not disengage them.
It seems as if the whole brain fitness movement has turned into a fad, and there's a lot of different programs that you can get on the internet. And
right.
I know that one of the things that Posit Science tries to do is tries to scientifically validate your programs. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, that's a commitment to what we're doing here, and we're not distributing anything that we haven't demonstrated works. And the claims that we make are meant to be almost like medical claims. They're based upon having done control studies. And I mean control studies in a sort of gold standard way. And we're trying to have those control studies being conducted by people outside of our immediate company because, well, first of all, we want to know in an objective way that what we're doing works. And where it's constructed to be continuously improvable, we're trying to define where we're at from the point of view of how we can help people at any given point in time. And then we're working immediately on the next iterative version of what we're doing so that not too far in the future, we can provide something substantially better and stronger.
So you started out with a program that is hearing-centered.
That's right. Hearing and language, you could say, because the operations in receiving information from listening in a human life and your use of language are incredibly powerful contributors to your operations in a life, and they're subject to really strong deterioration in the average older life. And we can improve them very substantially by intensively training them.
It's making me wonder whether my lack of what I call my lack of aptitude for foreign language is actually a hearing issue.
Well, it is in part a hearing issue because one of the first things you need to do to acquire proficiency in a second language is to operate in accurate listening so that you can interpret those complex sounds changing in real time. And that's commonly a hang up. It's commonly really delays and often frustrates the development of the ability to operate in a second language. It's not that you couldn't learn to read it on some level, but actually operate in it as a direct oral user of the language, a receiver of the language, is very, very frustrating for many individuals. And even when they learn it in a kind of baby talk form. And when they hear it at real speed, it's impossible for them to deal with. In a sense, that's what happens in an old brain. Old brains are pretty good as long as everybody talks deliberately and slowly. They make a few errors then. You can demonstrate that if you just deliver words one at a time in a random way to a person above about 60, and they miss about 5% of them, a surprisingly large number. But when they hear words in a continuous flow, they have enough information from the context so that that doesn't really matter very much. But if you just speed up that speech by 25%, so now the normal speech rate is 25% faster than normal, you can reach a condition in which a substantial percentage of people over 60 understand almost nothing. Okay, so you don't have to challenge them very much before they have a complete breakdown. Now, a 20 or 30 or 40-year-old at a 25% compression of speech hears everything. You just aren't resolving the information with the same precision in detail, in time, or in frequency on the same level as you were when you're younger, but that's substantially improvable. You can improve those abilities dramatically in most older individuals. And that improvement results in very substantial increase in accuracy in interpreting what you hear. And then when you improve its accuracy at speed, you're basically providing much more powerful fed-forward information to the memory operations, to the cognitive operations of your brain from listening.
So hearing better helps you remember better?
Hearing better helps you remember better. If you represent information in more detail, in a stronger, more powerful way, that information, in a sense, gets through. It's interpreted more accurately, and it's interpreted at higher speed. You can measure all of those things in a brain, and you can measure all of them in the performance abilities of an individual that's trained. You actually see improvements of the efficiency of the operations of their brain that reflect this more effective fed-forward information.
Since the principle that you use in this seems to be sort of starting out hearing stuff slower and speeding it up, how does that translate into doing visual work?
Well, in vision, again, we start with a person making easy distinctions in relatively slow speed forms. You're alluding to the visual training program that we've created and have widely provided called Insight. And all of those start in a person making visual distinctions about what they see under relatively slow and non-time challenge conditions. And that's because if you look at the performance of an older person as they operate in vision, the most striking limitations that they have relate to how they operate when they're sampling information at speed. And the reason that that occurs is because basically as you get older, you spend more and more time looking at things directly in front of you in the center of gaze. You have less and less command of the visual field that's away from the center of gaze. Basically, that's occurring because you're struggling just a little bit in making accurate distinctions about the things you're seeing in front of you without thinking. You're spending more and more time staring at the things in front of you, moving your eyes less and less, doing less and less sampling. And that means that your ability to process information that's coming in when the sampling rate is higher, that is to say, if your eyes were moving more rapidly, is more and more degraded because you're getting less and less information. You can think of a young person, when they see something that's interesting that's in front of them or off to the side, their eyes move to it and they bounce around on it 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 times a second. And they're getting a series of snapshots, providing the basis of a highly resolved reconstruction of what it is that they're seeing. An older person might move their eyes to it, but they just stare at it. And they commonly do relatively little exploration of it, if they move to it at all. And basically now we put them in a time challenge training exercise and challenge them to make distinctions about things that are happening all at speed, and they simply cannot do it. In fact, it's just amazing for me to be behind the computer screen of a 70, 75, 80-year-old and watch what they can't see, because they can't see things that are so big and bold to me. I'm 66. But I might say I've spent a lot of time training myself on these visual training programs and really can't improve anymore on them. But I cannot believe what they can't see. When we improve these operations, we can get those eyes to brighten up again. We can get them to move again. We do get them to move again. We can open them up so they see the whole world again. They no longer have those blinders on from primarily operating on things just in front of their nose. And we can get them to move the eyes rapidly to something that emerges that's surprising in the scene and bounce around it just like a young person. As a consequence of that, they're getting much more complete information from it. They're reconstructing what they see more completely, and they remember it better.
Wow. What do you see as the biggest challenge coming up? I guess I may be skipping ahead.
Well, one of the things that we're doing now, Ginger, is we're focusing on people that have more problems than the problems that apply to the normally aging individual. And there are people that are in more trouble still. One class of those people are people that are approaching the onset of senile dementia, of forms of Alzheimer's disease or its kin. What we're working on intensely are in strategies that are trying to reverse the functional abilities of the older person at risk for that end-of-life catastrophe, to strengthen them enough so that we delay the onset or its effective onset so that the person can live independently for a substantially longer period of time, maybe to the end of their natural life. So that's one of the areas of focus. The second group of people that we're strongly focused on that are more substantially impaired are people that suffer from psychotic illness. Our main target there has been active schizophrenics, and we've developed complicated training programs that are designed to drive the cognitive performance abilities of people with schizophrenia as far in a normal way direction as possible. We have very strong effects, stronger effects than have been achieved with any medicine that I know of, that very substantially contribute to rehabilitating such an individual, to helping them reestablish themselves independently in the community again. And we've demonstrated that we were able to do that. So we're trying to now carry the evaluation of the use of those tools through a Food and Drug Administration review process, because we want the world to view that as medicine.
Right.
To think of that as something that should be prescribed to somebody, you could say, that is almost necessary for them to have to be better. That represents a very inexpensive alternative way to think about how you would help such a person get better and maybe thrive again in a more natural life. And there's a whole series of related extensions of this in the psychotically ill population that we're trying to get to that relate to that.
I've been recently getting quite a few emails from people that have been affected by head trauma. Do you think that there's any potential for this kind of work? I would guess there would be for people with head trauma.
We've applied it in small studies. We have a study that's ongoing that's being conducted at Walter Reed Hospital in soldiers that have suffered from IED explosion exposures where they have diffuse trauma. We've also given software to the Easter Seals that have given it to a substantial number of returning Iraqi veterans who have been exposed to IED explosions primarily. And the measurements that we've got back from those studies are very, very positive. We've also applied it in individuals that have diffuse brain injury from other reasons, for example, in individuals that have had brain infections. So examples of that would be AIDS dementia or loss of cognitive abilities that are impairing an individual to the extent to which they're at high risk for the onset of dementia and have lost their job and so forth. We've had good impacts there. Or in people that have had diffuse trauma that comes from things like chemotherapy. Several studies have now been conducted in breast cancer survivors where the chemotherapy has had such a strong impact on their cognitive abilities that the individuals have significant impairment. We've been able to show that we can substantially reverse that and so forth. So there are a whole range of uses of intense training strategies to drive the brain in strengthening your positive directions using this class of tools. Now, it's complicated because the ideal strategies applied to each one of these populations are a little bit differentiated from every other one. There are significant individual differences in how the ideal programs would be shaped for each of these populations, but there's also a lot of overlap. Because in almost all of these cases, we can use general principles of plasticity to drive the brain to represent information in higher fidelity, more accurately at high speed. So there's a lot of overlap. We don't have to reinvent the wheel every time we approach another one of these problems. But there also is significant differentiation, and especially when you come to populations like people who have suffered from stroke, where to some extent the individual losses that apply one patient to another have to be dealt with.
Right. So if an individual was interested in trying to use the programs that you're developing, would it be more appropriate for them to contact Posit Science directly, or would it be appropriate for them to buy one of the programs, or what would you recommend?
Well, they can take either approach. They can try it. It's not going to be harmful for them to use it. I mean, we know of no inherent dangers or problems with using it in that respect. Or they could contact us in our research group here, and we might be interested in helping them and guiding them in some sense or advising them in some sense. And we might be interested in helping them as being a source of information back to us and whether or not it does possibly impact them in the condition that applies for them. So they're very welcome to contact us, but they're also very welcome to give it a try.
The programs that you have that are aimed at the general public, do you have recommendations about what age a person should be before starting into those programs?
Well, I think that a person at any age can benefit from the use of this. And to some extent, it matters more on the conditions of whether you perceive a need or not. A 20-year-old can have a need in improving their visual or their listening operations or their cognitive operations. And a 60-year-old can be doing just great, right? There are families in which there is an inherited weakness that can put a person at risk for the early onset of something very bad happening, like Alzheimer's disease. At a relatively young age, a person might think about doing things prophylactically that make them stronger. And this is one of those things that they could think about doing. It's to some extent individual. Basically, the software is designed to find the performance level of an individual and drive them to a higher level. So it might find the performance level of the average 40-year-old to be quite a bit higher than the performance level of the average 70-year-old. It will find that. But then it will drive all of them as far as they can go in a positive or corrective direction. And almost everybody's improvable.
And I got an email recently that indicates you finally have Mac version.
Yeah, we do. Yeah, about time, huh?
One thing is that your programs are relatively expensive. So from the standpoint of, say, someone who's trying to sort out all these different things that are on the internet, is there any advice that you would offer?
Well, the problem is that most things that are applied and most things that are out there are unproven from the point of view of their use.
Yeah.
The benefits that might describe going across the landscape. There are some things that are inexpensive that I think are obviously more useful or more likely to be useful than other things. But the problem is that there's almost never a control study that demonstrates a utility. It's sort of surprising when a company that might have, let's say, $10 or $12 billion in revenue won't do a control study, right? But that's the reality of it. There are even large players in this landscape that just haven't done scientific studies that determine whether what they do actually has any benefit or not.
Because there's nothing like the FDA to force them to, I guess.
Yeah, and I think that this has got to change. Of course, it does make things more expensive. It's one of the things that contributes to expense. So, you know, if you run a controlled trial on one of these things, you're talking about the kind of expenses that apply in running controlled trials for drugs.
Right.
It's just costly as hell to do that, so it's not free. But on the other hand, how can you sell something and make promises to people about how it will make them better or stronger without having any real evidence? And ideally, that's unequivocal evidence that those statements about its efficacy, the benefits that can come from it, are true. And what kind of value do you get by doing something in which there is no such support? So I think somehow we have to clear up this landscape. It's a mess of a landscape. And we have to have some kind of standard on it, because at this point, no one can know what to believe. It's just a mess. And all I can say about what we do is we know it works. We're not distributing anything. We're not providing anything to anybody that we do not have good evidence that it's going to be effective for the uses to which it's applied, except in these experimental cases that we talked about a few minutes ago.
Right. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me today, Dr. Merznick. Is there anything else you'd like to share with my listeners before we close?
Take your brain fitness seriously, because it's all up to you. And remember that you have this great asset that you carry around within your skull to be stronger, to be better. It's more or less up to you if you utilize it or if you allow yourself to deteriorate in ways that just aren't necessary or completely necessary, and keep up the good fight.
Thank you.
Enjoyed talking to you, Ginger.
I did too. Thanks so much.
You bet.
Bye. I want to thank Dr. Merznick for coming on the Brain Science Podcast. Remember that you can find show notes and links at our website, brainsciencepodcast.com. The transcript of this episode should be available by the end of February. We now have two people working on transcripts, so I hope that we will have all the back episodes available by the end of 2009. If there's a particular episode that you need, please let me know. You can share your comments and feedback by sending me email at docartemis@gmail.com or by participating in our discussion forum at brainscienceforum.com. The Brain Science Podcast is copyright 2009, Virginia Campbell, MD. You can copy this podcast to share it with others. But for any other uses or derivatives, please contact me at docartemis@gmail.com.